I don't know any of you. Well, I know a few of you, but I don't know you well. And when I have, I double as the vice president for diversity and inclusion, and one of the things I do in my meetings is I make people tell me something odd about themselves. And that's kind of interesting when the people in there are board members and the president, who doubles as my supervisor. But I think we'll do that now. It functions both as an icebreaker, but more than that, it's a little bonding piece. It's kind of weird in higher ed. We sit around a lot next to a person, meetings and whatever, and we know very little about them, except the stage persona that they show us. So we're going to try to get on the other side of that for a minute. So if you would give me your name, and let's say, tell me a movie that shook you up a little bit at some point. Is that okay? Okay. So we'll start with Eric. And don't get all pedantic on me, okay? Just give me a real answer about a movie that shook you up.
That comment didn't have anything to do with, like, okay, I'm Erica Lehrer, and I guess the first thing that comes to mind is it may actually be the last movie I saw, and I'm going to pronounce it in really bad French, but I think it's Incendie, which was made by a Montreal filmmaker, I think, about a fictionalized story about brother and sister who go back to some unnamed country in the Middle East to find what happened to their mother, and it turns into a sort of allegory of everything that's wrong in the Middle East, but is incredibly troubling and involves lots of violence of various kinds.
Okay.
Yep.
Very good.
My name's Anna Schechtel, and off the top of my head, I would say what comes to mind the most are movies that, like, traumatized me as a child. Mm. So for the Canadians in the room, I'd say the most obvious movie is The Peanut Butter Solution, which is a movie about a kid who loses all his hair and then learns this, like, peanut buttery mixture that gets spread on his body that makes the hair grow back, but then it won't stop growing. And it's not like I had nightmares about this. So it kind of freaks me out.
Oh, and by the way, try not to do this. Try not to be thinking about your movie and what you're going to say about your movie as other people are talking. That's a higher ed. We're trying to unlearn some things right now. This is about actually listening to that person. Like, I'm fascinated. So, Peter, I didn't know that, so I'm going to have to watch this movie. Go ahead.
I'm Stacey Zimbarki, and I don't really watch movies. Nothing really comes to mind at this moment, but what came to mind when you said that was anything written by Primo Levi.
Okay.
My name is Huli Gatayan, and I'm having a memory lapse here. I can't remember the name of the movie, which is weird, but I think it was the graphic novel by the Israeli director about his experience in Lebanon.
Walsh Bashir.
Thank you so much. Being Lebanese, I should have remembered it, but anyway. It freaked me out, and I loved it at the same time because it was very much. I was watching it. I'm from Lebanon. I've lived through what he describes, and it was incredible for me seeing how he dealt with it within a graphic novel and within making that into a film and how that the attachment he had to it.
Okay.
Laura Ross. I teach communications here. Two things came to mind. I can't figure out which one I should tell you about. One is the Battle of Algiers, which kind of freaked me out about looking at the whole Muslim revolution and development and abuse and the role of women in it particularly, and what kind of psychological mechanism is going on there, psychological scars of living in an abusive society. And the other one is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which blew my mind, because I was into studying psychology and psychiatry, and was into anti-psychiatry and all that stuff at the time it came out, and it was really a powerful
film. Okay.
Yeah, it still is.
Yes.
My name is Amber Burson, and I would say, it didn't shake me up because it was disturbing, but I saw The King's Speech with my grandma recently, and then it turned into this nice discussion about her hearing that speech on the radio when she was a kid, and what it was like for her entering a war, and that was really powerful.
Okay.
I'm Bernard Opliger. I don't shock very easily. Having said that, the last movie that really shocked me was this Korean movie called Old Boy. I won't get into the details, because if I get into the details, I'll ruin the movie, but it's this guy that gets imprisoned for 15 years, and he doesn't know why, and then he's just kind of released one day, and has to kind of piece together why he was taken away from his family. And it's, yeah, there's a twist at the end. It's really horrible.
Okay.
My name is Angelina Malego. I guess the movie that disturbed me the most recently would be Muffins for Granny. It's an ethno-documentary about residential school experiences that was put out by a postdoc graduate. Anyway, this film that we go with, it's really disturbing.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Ali Schachter, and I want to say the most chilling film, one of which is probably Blood Diamond. Kind of speaks for itself. So.
Okay.
I'm Monica Patterson, and the film I will speak about is one that I use in teaching about South Africa quite a bit. It's a documentary about Sandra Lang, who is a colored girl in South Africa. She was born to white parents, and then because of the tint of her skin and the texture of her hair, she was officially reclassified as colored. Her race was switched three different times in the legal system of apartheid, and the thing that just destroys me every time in this documentary is toward the end when they talk to her mother, who was estranged from her, I think, you know, in large part because of the pressure she received from her husband. So it's just a devastating example of how these larger legal and social structures just destroy the most intimate personal landscapes that we have, even in contradiction to, you know, our feelings sometimes.
Do you remember the name of that film?
Well, there was actually a documentary that was made at the time in the 70s, I believe, In Search of Sandra Lang. It was made by anti-apartheid activists. And then she has recently come out with a book called When I Was White. It's co-written with someone else. It was on Oprah's book list. And then I believe that there was a news sort of a South African-based news channel that followed up and created their own sort of pastiche drawn from the original documentary and adding some contemporary stuff. But you can find it on YouTube if you Google their name.
Okay.
My name is Kim. For some reason, the movie that popped in my head was the documentary that Chris Rock produced, Hair, I think it's called.
Good Hair.
Good Hair, yeah. And the reason it hit me really because it just occurred to me watching it, like how much bigger that story really is, and it was made for a very accessibly for a very wide audience.
Well, I used to have good hair when I would go to the barbershops, and I grew up, you know, in a all black place. I was the least black person. And we used to joke down south that in Alabama the weather's better, the whites are mean, and the blacks are blacker. And it's a real southern kind of thing to say. And actually, it even feels odd saying that out loud and without the context. But when I would go get my hair cut, you know, the barbers would say, "Oh, he's got good hair." And it had so many layers, what that meant. My hair was curly, but it was the curls weren't as tightly wrapped, you know, as... Now, going bald, almost any hair seems to me to be a blessing. Anyway, my favorite movie, my name's David Pearl. That's actually not my name. It's my middle name. My name is Eustace. But I went by David most of my life, which is my middle name. And but my favorite movie is To Serve with Love. And it's this really pathetic need I have for validation from students. And always hoped at the end of a semester that my students would stand up and one of them would sing To Sir With Love as if they were Lulu. I don't know. If you saw the movie, you that would be good. All right, I want you to say A, B, or C.
A.
A.
C.
see. All right, good. All right, what I want you to do is I need one person writing, and the rest of you, I need you to quit that incessant note-taking. And so designate a person to write for your group. Is that all right? It's a little hierarchy thing. Why does one person get to write? That person is favored. Can't get from over there. Someone changed the tables in such a way that it prohibits an ease of transit. So who's the writer over here? All right. I'm going to give you an object, and here's the thing. Who's your writer? It seems wrong in some way to have the two of you as the writers, but that's right.
Nobody else wants to do it.
No, grunt work. Okay, good. All right. What this exercise is called the storm, and what it is it's like an icebreaker exercise for people that come into the museum. Okay. Keep in mind that most people that come in there may not have ease with discussing race and issues of race. And so it's a very simple exercise, and that is this. I'm going to give you an undetermined amount of time. And in that time, what you're going to do is you're going to just write everything that comes to your mind. It can be hopefully single words or just two words or, very short phrases. So I'll give you the object. And typically, I would make you wear gloves, but I'm not going to make you do it for a couple reasons. One is that we have triples of the stuff that I brought, and so if you damage it with the microorganisms in your grimy fingers, it won't hurt as much. So you're free to take this out of the bag in your case. Normally we wouldn't do that, and yours you don't have that problem because it's not a piece of cloth, as it were. So take that out, and then what you want to do? You said what? Let's see. I don't want you to censor yourself, please. Just so you can handle it. Every thought that comes to your mind, no censoring.
You mean like you think?
I don't know.
do they have to remain there? And just like that's not usually.
That's true.
So it's like an iPhone.
Why would they make it
this
character to just
and then
for
when you can travel? Like,
why don't
you
do so?
Yeah, but then you have like the little
stands.
Yeah, like maybe if they're coming back, if they're coming out of yourself,
they should.
Are the same images on the other side?
Yeah.
The others are wearing shoes, the back of the
music.
posture to make yourself look tired.
Posture.
Yeah.
See, that
in your head, you sort of like this.
I don't know if
it's
subcultural posture.
Because I would agree that my assumption was just like that this would be born by like black kids, but not
and
it
stands
for posture to make them seem tougher. And I could be totally wrong. That's like if we vote.
I don't think it's cool enough.
That was the representation of everybody, right?
What's cool?
We
call
it vote. Zombie music from the chase. It's all about the
Germans,
you know. Chase
the indie issue.
Itchy.
I'm also wondering why you have somebody else bought an extra large.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too.
I was thinking we need actually the extra large down. Japanese kids in Tokyo.
Little
shack.
I'm not the expert.
Like you go in the bathroom.
No, but there's just that lens to it.
Oh, that's true.
You can hide stuff underneath it.
Like
things you stole from the desk. That's more what I was
thinking.
Okay, let's stop. And what I'm going to ask you to do now is to, and this will be a little bit hard, so maybe the way we'll get around this is I'll put this on. And it used to be the case, not so much these days, but it used to be the case that I would try to experience whatever object we purchased. So if we bought a Klan robe, believe it or not, I would wear it. If we bought a book, I'd read it. Sometimes I got really... am I not lined up here? That's all right. Yeah, but you would think at my age I would have figured out how to line up a shirt. So they looked at this object, and I want you to listen to what they said, and then I want you to think about some things, some responses to what they wrote, okay? And so I feel like a really bizarre model right now. Okay. So in a kind of a slow pace, can you read what you wrote?
Polyester. Ugly, hatred, rappers, faceless, Fat Albert, gunshot, Kirkland, gang, lips, ghetto blaster, peeing, brands, pagers, mean, toothless, macho, men, isolated, faceless, bad, aggressive, threatening, fashion, bling, menacing, waiting, street corner, bragging, dirty, poor, sneakers, something to prove, tough, symbols, membership, handicapped, animal, don't mess with me, code, marking territory, animalistic, camouflage, caps, disguise, costume, uniform, music, unhealthy, exaggerated face, competing, conflict, posturing, voguing, subcultural, worn by black kids trying to be tough, and huge size, like the big size of the shirt.
Which happens to actually fit me. But I have a sweater on. He hastened to add. And now I need this group right here to quickly tell me
your first impressions of this, if you see something maybe that they didn't mention.
Correct, and it fixes it in place.
Fixes it in place. Okay. What else?
Stigma.
Hold those thoughts. And now we're going to look at, I'm going to give you this back. I think the world would be a lot better if we did what we're doing today with most things that we see. But like fish in water, we rarely think about where we are until we're on the land. And so they have a different object. And let me hold it. I can give it to them. I'm going to put it here because if I put it too close to you, you won't listen to anything they're saying. Okay, so go ahead and give me what you wrote about that up.
Okay. Should I
come in?
Stop the David Pilgrim
film? Well, at least for a minute it is.
Oh, come gee, in. That's good. My come name is Suzanne Bruno, and I was invited here by another institution.
Okay, all right.
And I'd just like to sit in.
Sure, absolutely, absolutely.
Thank you very much.
All right.
So this. Should I say what it is? It
yeah, whatever you, that. Whatever came to mind.
So this, we think, is it's a receptacle for putting notes. There's some blank note paper inside. It reads, if you all don't find nobody home, just leave a note with me. And there's a caricatured image. So we imagine that it would go on the outside of someone's house, maybe next to their mailbox, next to their front door, and people leave notes. So these are the words that came up. The South, bad grammar, accents, old wood, cluelessness, monkey, especially the lips, the ears, scratching the head, racism. This is an item for public viewing. Civil rights movement. I don't get it. Humorous. Contradictory in terms of the messages about literacy, asking for a note to be left, but then the bad grammar that was used. Stupid, a poor person's black servant, stigma, generally acceptable tourist item or memento. It's also stamped on the bottom, St. Petersburg, Florida. Cheap, produced not in a factory, but probably multiple versions of that were produced. Confused, lower class, porch monkey, low class, and weathered and faded. So it seems like it's an object that has actually been used.
Okay. And now I'll let you pass this around and give me some things maybe that are different from what they said.
I feel like I'm struck by the idea that it's supposed to be sort of cute or clever.
Okay.
And like funny.
Okay. What?
Do we know when these are produced?
No. That's not the discussion
that's
we're having yet.
Gotcha.
Kind of like the orange monkey.
Okay.
Crude.
Okay.
The probably for the next to the phone. Or
just kind of humiliating, I guess. Yeah, also, I mean, they said monkey, but just animalistic in general.
All right, a couple quick things. You're now going to do the second part of the exercise, and you may want to literally... pick
join
one of those
group.
Groups. Yeah, join one of those. Okay. Are you not a joiner?
I'm a joiner.
You're a joiner. Who was it? Who was the person who said I wouldn't want to be in a group that would have me as a member? Was that Groucho Marx? Okay. All right, now the second exercise is a little more difficult. And this exercise is totally hypothetical, because in the real world, this would not happen. If you were working in a museum and you were writing a placard, you pretty much have as many words as it takes to explain what it is you need to explain. I'm not going to let you have that luxury. What I'm going to ask you to do as a group is to come up with 25 words exactly. And those 25 words will be next to the object. And the only thing the visitor knows, remember, this is just hypothetical. The only thing the visitor knows is what they see and what your 25 words say. There's no docent. This is a docent-less museum. It's like I said, it's just hypothetical. So between the six of you and the five of you, I want 25 words to tell me that you believe are absolutely critical. That someone, and in sentence form, not just words, got to be intelligent. And no hyphenated words, no cheating. Okay? You may start. There you go. You're actually going to end up working in the museum one day.
Are you telling us how much time we have or no?
No.
Say, you know, this, you know.
Well, I think the whole point is like there's very few.
jungle. I'm an animal, and I am there to serve. I don't exist.
Remember now, the person doesn't know anything about the object other than what they can see and what you write. And you've all been in museums before. And sometimes didactic panels become philosophical engagers. But other times, they just describe what it is the thing is. So these are thoughts.
I got some thoughts, too.
Anything about the show?
shirt in there?
Yes, no. The curators think this
I mean, like the actual shirt and stuff. You do mention it's a shirt in there somewhere, although they can see that.
Right, because
right,
we can't see anything they can't
see
because we don't have any more information.
Are they going to make
us
see the label that says
this
feature
is a
shirt?
Are
they going to be able to
tell that, you know, if it was a shirt, this group is a shirt.
It's contemporary.
Is there some idea about when it was made?
It's contemporary or you already introduced the shirt, which depicts estimation. And so,
implementation.
Yeah, just
Korean
made.
Yeah.
Can't blame
myself.
Yeah,
because when you see people being made, and then you're this whole assumption of cheapness, taking jobs away from Americans, all this other stuff, and that is.
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
Because now we have to popularize and to continue the stigma. Would you wear this? Why? Exactly. Temporary.
But what if we could link it to like the roots of shirts?
Like, you know, there's no harm in what occurs at dangerous lazy structures. What do you say? Like, there's
roots. That's my thought exactly.
Yes. Are we all cool with that? We can change it.
What do you see or what do you think?
Are you on board, Mary?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, because the theory is to give a pass.
I'm just worried.
We can pass it around.
Does this vote positive or negative associations for you.
I really
what they what may they be. Engage with the person standing next to you in a discussion about what your associations are with their associations.
Would it be okay if you sat with that group?
Sure.
If you were, yes, that? And you with that group?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Unless you wanted to just... then that's fine. Then don't sit with them. You have a different purpose. Yes, that's good. Although it's okay to participate also.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
I'm getting ready to do something mean to them anyway, so... How you guys doing?
I want to.
All right, let me be a jerk right now. Which comes easy. Is it too early to be a jerk?
Well, can you say look at the, and then to say words, don't say look at the again. You say look at the blah.
Semicolon.
Semicolon, blah.
Or how about, could you use your words?
You might find
people
offensive, but you don't find like a black and gay.
I just
left.
Also, look, this is bad. If we use the stereotypes, would you read this? Why?
Yeah, I thought about that. The stereotype is the loaded word.
That's a stereotype, and now we're actually you were
imagery.
Say yes.
How about imagery?
Perpetuating that. Yeah.
Imagery is
the stereotype. Maybe it's just like, how does this make you feel? That's a good question. That makes sense to think.
Because the point of stereotype is saying, like, we don't actually think answers.
What about this?
Yeah, I don't know that. But, you know, like, they should look at that image.
So we're about done?
No.
No. All right, let's take 3 minutes.
We're almost there.
You're almost there?
She's crossed her fingers.
Something that you could be proud of and feel good about? Yes, you do. Are you quick?
I am not.
There's so many adjectives. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay.
That's 13 words, just the sentence. This contemporary mass-produced Korean made shirt depicts urban entrepreneur gangsta country. Now the questions. We have 12 words. We had, would you wear this why? We had,
or how about, what
talk to your neighbor about,
no, I don't know.
What do you see, what do you think? We have the whole, is it positive or is it negative?
If these placards were off, did they make them into the museum?
Would they what?
Would they make them into the museum?
I don't think they had placards.
If they were great, yeah, we will. Actually, we have to write placards for all the objects. Well, not all, but many. But no, this won't make it in there. No, it may. It depends.
It's not free labor. Okay. 12 words. Let's go.
I kind of like the positive or negative stuff. It is the leading point. Especially in people identifying with the three words. The words are pretty impressive.
Is this something you would wear?
Why not
go to the original question we had? What do you see in it? No?
Oh, but the what we also asked about the one to point out specific imagery, which I don't know if we like.
Okay, stop.
And now you stop, just for a moment.
Okay, go ahead.
The CUTV people, I just want to take some B-roll for an interview they're going to do later with David Pilgrim. So is there anybody who doesn't want to be filmed, has any problem with being filmed? No. Okay, they'll just do their business.
I love this place that you would ask that is so conscientious.
Okay, that's my middle name.
Yes.
And
like,
after
I
won't
use the audio or anything. It's just
silent
visual,
B-roll.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, stop. All right, did everybody stop? Okay, one conversation now. A couple things. One, obviously for me, the important part here is the process, not the outcome. I mean, I imagine that at one point someone will come up with a panel that just blows me away.
And actually, we are having to write. We spent a whole year coming up with six stories to tell in the new museum. And I personally have the responsibility of writing the didactic panels that go in the section. So, and I heard some wonderful things, but it's the process. Now, I have done this exercise before, and because people are smart and task-oriented, I've had people physically threaten me when I didn't let them finish. That's losing sight of the big picture, Erica. Okay, so that's one thing. Second point is this. How many of you are familiar with ethnomethodology? It's kind of a little known part of sociology, as it were. But one of the premises of ethnomethodology is that when we write reports, the reports say at least as much about the writer of the report as they do about the thing that's being reported. So when you read a social worker's client report, that person may or may not be as they're depicted in the report, but it does tell me about the social workers, their academic training, their worldview, and the like. Same thing with police reports, and same thing with people that write didactic panels. And so while you were coming up with what you thought should go on here, I was listening to the words that come out of your mouth. Okay, so in a sense, the panels will tell us at least as much about you as it does about the shirt. Does that make sense? Okay. A couple questions I'd like to have for you. Let's start with this one. What was the biggest challenge for you? And don't name the person. But let's start with this group over here. What was the biggest challenge?
I think our challenge was whether to make it like a straightforward descriptive thing, which we felt uncomfortable doing because we didn't want to make any assumptions about it.
Okay.
Versus making it sort of self-reflexive, like bringing it up to the audience.
Okay. Any other challenges?
And also including the we of the curators event. Right.
Acknowledging
the voice.
Okay, and why would it be important to include that or not include it?
Erica?
Because, I mean, usually in museums.
Is that a shifting blame thing? Or responsibility?
I take the fall for everything. Frequently in museums, almost all the time, there are like these voiceless, like sort of voiceless, or not voiceless, just displaced omniscient view. It's like, this is an X, it means X. And it's like, who wrote this? How am I, you know, and also that you get the sense of like, okay, whoever that godly voice is knows, so who am I to say what I think it is? You just say, that's what it is, right? So, that's all. And I'll add then what I found challenging is to find any descriptive term. If you wanted to try to focus people's attention on looking closely and reading this thing closely, any descriptive term that you could use that, in fact, didn't impose a way of seeing on it. So could you even say, okay, we didn't want to say, oh, it's racist. We didn't want to say it's even stereotyped. We didn't want to say, you don't want to shut people down, but could you say toothless peeing? Like, what can you say to get people to look closely without kind of antagonizing or shutting down if they see it as something positive.
Oh yeah, and how can you provoke them to talk about it without imposing how you want them to talk about it? Yeah.
Okay. All right, this group. By the way, you did read. I did let you read it, right?
No.
Can you read what you wrote?
This is not a consensus. What came out of here? This is like whoever got the paper last and just did their thing, right? So. This contemporary, mass-produced, Korean-made shirt depicts urban African-American gangsta imagery. What do you see?
And obviously that didn't get all the way to 25 because I stopped before we got there.
Yeah. We wanted kind of a better question for the conversation.
Yeah.
We couldn't
agree with the last, whether it was too aloof saying what you see or do we want them to be more engaging with it. Would you wear it?
And you seem and to be struggling with the idea that there are good values and bad values, or that you should be trying to pick between them, that's not necessarily the role of a museum or the role of an exhibit.
I think, well, what Erica said that stuck with me was, and related to your talk last night, was this idea of not trying to shut down.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, if a kid walks in and he's wearing that shirt, mm-hmm. or he's got that shirt in his closet, you don't want to shut down that conversation. Being a space in which that kid can talk about the
Well, what if he walks in with a shirt that says, forgive my language, this says, because I've seen this on a person, it's another long story, bitch, don't make me pull an OJ on you. All right? And you have a shirt, and instead of that shirt, that's the shirt you have. Do you still not want him to reflect on the messages in that shirt? Are you such moral weenies that you feel like... Did I say that out loud? Are you... Can you say nothing? Can you say nothing is wrong? Is that where we are? Mm-hmm. And can you do even a little bit of that without killing all dialogue?
Mm-hmm. That's definitely the conversation we had that went back and forth between us, yeah, putting something vague and then going, that's meaning, mm-hmm.
Does this group have any questions or comments? Does this group have any questions or comments about what you've heard they went through? All right. Yes.
It's interesting to think that, like, the idea of projecting an opinion on mm-hmm. things, right? I lost the tail end of that thought. But yeah, I mean, if you don't project a certain moral value onto objects of hatred, in particular, people can look at it and affirm what they see in it. And I guess it depends who's beside them and who they're talking to. But if that
Well, now I'm going to do an Erica, because I'm going to look at this from a. I'm thinking to myself, we were in a Holocaust museum yesterday, and not some of the, death images, but let's say like some of the unpleasant, like poverty images about the camps. I think there's a way to take that logic I'm hearing, where the placard just said life in the camps. Right. And what does that do or not do? I mean, it is, on the one hand, obviously you're assuming the person can see that there's some bad stuff happening here. But should the museum have an overarching story reflected in the text of individual pieces, or should the story be this sort of fine, what's the, Waldo type thing? I'd stretch that point way too far there. The point I'm asking is couldn't you say something about it, in terms of values? Yes.
Well, you already are if it's in a museum called the Blah Blah Museum
okay.
of Racist
okay.
something.
All right.
And also, now I'm going to forget. Kim forgot her question. I'm going to forget mine. Yeah, I mean, if you already say it's an object of hatred, then that's a really powerful frame, and so and that's fine.
Uh-huh.
But it is gonna if a kid who has this at home and might wear it because it makes him feel tough and it makes him feel good, and it's part of his given the sort of tools that are available, it makes him feel like more comfortable as a person walking down the street, or it's like gives him some feeling of dignity. If you just slam him with you're perpetuating hatred with this, I think that doesn't capture the whole story, and it might, it might stop a process. It might start a process of thinking, but it might stop it. And so I'm wondering if there's some level of specificity or something you can get to open it up without being like, you're hating with this shirt.
Okay. Yes.
What I'm going to say, some people might think that it provokes hatred or whatever. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
And that's what we initially had, right? Was we think, like, what we see when we see this is X, so how about you? And then we
then it would be really
got nervous
that's
about
really
us.
Rather than
some
we,
yeah, no, I agree.
It takes it away from
a bunch of, white people sitting around.
Yeah. And we got uncomfortable with having ourselves in here.
Well, did you feel white during this exercise?
Yeah, I feel like I don't have the authority to talk about it.
Really? What would give you the authority? I mean, a black suburban kid... Does that person have more authority to talk about this than you?
No, but it's a culture that's really alien to us. And I feel like we're crossing lines in terms of making judgment calls about it,
mm-hmm.
which is something that you don't necessarily do with the Holocaust, because the Holocaust is just, it's bad, right? It happened. Anti-Semitism is awful. You can make judgments about that more easily because it's not as great.
So you can't speak about anything about African-American culture then?
It's also important to remember that we're in Canada, so we don't have the same African-American culture here that's so very much present
in America. But I'm curious, how much do you have to know about African-American culture to describe what it is you're seeing? Mm-hmm. I mean, do you have to know the life and times of W.B. Du Bois? And do you have to know the latest hip-hop song? Do you have to know that stuff in order to describe what it is?
It's not about knowledge to me, it's about authority.
Okay, but what's the... Okay, and I get that distinction, but what I'm saying is, what would give you the authority? Mm-hmm. Are you simply saying that living as a black person would give you that authority?
I'm saying I don't have an opinion on who has the authority. I just know I don't have.
Okay, but I don't want you backing out that easy. Okay, because this is a big question. This is a big question. I have white docents, mm-hmm. and they are often challenged purely on the fact that they're white. Mm-hmm. All right, and it's become fashionable in progressive circles to talk about who has authority to talk about what. And what I'm thinking is that there are some things that come from being a lifelong participant observer, but I don't think everything comes from that. And I think that's too easy a way to keep from engaging what's in something. It's a politically right thing in many instances. But I want you to tell me, look in that side of you, what would give a person the authority to speak about that shirt? Yes.
Okay. I have something to say about this. It's because I'm biracial. Mm-hmm. Okay? I come from a black mother and a white father. So, do I have the authority? You know, what I'm saying is, what gives me the... Do I speak from a white perspective or a black perspective? Mm-hmm. Or do I speak from my perspective? Mm-hmm. And I think, as human beings, everybody has the authority. It's too easy to back away from saying, I don't have the authority to speak on this. If you've been in an experience, for example, if you were at a bus stop and you saw somebody get the hell beat out of them, and, you know, you were there, do you have the authority to say, well, this is what I saw? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you could choose not to have it, but you could choose to have it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I also think that I don't agree with, I don't feel the same way. I think that the question we have to ask is, like, what kind of a society do we live in where certain people feel they don't have authority to mm-hmm. talk about mm-hmm. an issue that is really important, mm-hmm. and that they do have an opinion about?
Mm-hmm. And it can be an informed
those
opinion.
Those are the questions we have to ask.
Absolutely.
What kind of structures have mm-hmm. repressed us to the point mm-hmm. where if we're white, we can't talk about anybody who's mm-hmm. different from us? Mm-hmm.
To be fair, Laura, I totally agree, and I guess I didn't express myself clearly. I don't think it's a good thing that I, like, I'm wussy like that, and I totally agree with you. I think the point is the conversation we're sitting having around the table is like, oh, we're so uncomfortable, we don't
yeah,
want to take
sure,
it.
Sure, absolutely.
And I
well, let me
I
tell you where I was
the
going.
The reality of, like, a lot of white folks dealing with these sorts of objects is that we get totally terrified.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. And let me tell you where I was going with that. I did a training session for the CIA in Chantilly, Virginia, in case you wonder where they are. Had to get butt naked 4 times. This is probably too much information. Just to get from where I needed to go all the way in, which I found offensive. Okay. First of all, you could trust the person that did me recently. So I'm in there with a bad attitude in the first place. And then second of all, I get in there, and the group I have is about this size, and they're almost equally blacks and whites, or people who would identify themselves as blacks and whites. And in that conversation, this became a dominant trend among the blacks, who tended to be middle-aged, these are executives, middle-aged, middle-upper class, highly educated, African-American, and except for one, female. But they have authority to speak because they're black. Okay? This was the dominant thing. We spent an hour with them saying this to me. Those are niggas on there. Okay? And I said, because most of the time in these sessions, I don't do a lot of talking. I just go, time's up. You know, kind of thing. This is a power thing. And I was like, excuse me? They're like, these are niggas. Well, we got to talk about that, right? Minute after minute after minute, I said to them, or they said to me, in response to my question, what is a nigga? Oh, let me explain to you.
The list of things you came up with is the same list of things they came up with, except they came up with those things as manifestations of what a nigga is. And I said to one person there, who are these niggas you keep talking about? She said, well, didn't you fly in through D.C.? I said, yeah. She said, well, didn't you meet them? All right? Now, we spent the profitable time of our session dealing with the prejudice that is class-based in African-American communities. This, that's not one of me. A nigga is really a low-income, undereducated, pants-sagging, loud music listening to, anti-establishment, aggressive, assert, and all of that. And we spent time. They wanted to convince me that these were niggas, and I wanted to deal with what that word meant sociologically, culturally, and within the group. But at no point in there did anyone make the assumption that they didn't have the authority to do that. You see where I'm going with this? It's much deeper than just who get. So, and I said to them, what gives you the authority to come to that point? The fact that you have melanin in your skin, you know, to a certain level means that you can do that. The fact that you have some shared experiences with poor black people, and out of those shared experiences you get this pass so that you can make that kind of comment. That was where that conversation went. So that's all that was all about, is not only did I find their values repugnant, and where the outcome of one of couple of those values and where they led them, but I also found it journey stopping that they hadn't paused at some point in a meaningful way and asked themselves the question of what authority I have to come to this. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I guess my thinking about it wasn't so much about authority, but it was about sort of what the fancy word we like to use is multivocality, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
That I think what's so important for revealing this air that we all breathe, but we breathe from different standpoints, is that we do have different experiences with this, and that, like, showing what those are, like, show how very differently positioned we are, right? So
mm-hmm.
I'd like some, I mean, I would like there to be multiple labels, the possibility for everybody to write their own label, and then
mm-hmm.
for each person to have to see, oh, wow, like, something like that. Because I do think that, I mean, I don't know if authority is the right word, but if someone, like, probably no one's going to look at me
mm-hmm.
and immediately start thinking about these other images. But I'm guessing that someone might look at you and some of these things might be floating around in their head, and that makes our experiences of life different.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that your experience of life has something, I don't know, more, I mean, maybe differently positioned, but intimate way with these images than mine does. And so that does give you something different to say about it that I want to hear, and I feel like I need to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of, like, I want to see that, and that's something that I can't contribute.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I want you to hear the different ones. Actually, I just had a thought, which is, you know how in museums people come in and they write their reflections on the way out? I think it would be profitable if, for some objects like this, this is what I was talking about last night, these kind of objects bring up much more stuff than some of the other pieces. I think it would be profitable to have a place where, and I'm sure there's a software out there that does this, that allows each person to come in the opportunity to write the placard for three or four objects, you know, spread out somewhere in the museum. I think that would be good. It would be good for me from research purposes, but I think it would be good generally. But I'm going to keep challenging the idea, though, that, again, I mean, I can't say you and I have experienced the world the same way. Obviously, we haven't. But it seems like when it comes to race and sexual orientation and some of these other things, that becomes too often a really easy way of saying, well, you know, that becomes a way of not engaging it. And sometimes that's a real fear, because you get members of minority groups who say, shut your mouth, you don't know what you're talking about, kind of thing. But that presupposes they know what they're talking about. you know, and that you don't. Let's quickly go to the other object. By the way, do you kind of see where the purpose of the exercise is? And it can go anywhere. If it was just about writing placards, it would be horrible. If you put five people in a room, it would take them literally 2 weeks to come up with a... And the smarter they are, the worse it is. And that's a fact. I mean, I have some bright people around. We can agree that what you just had was mild. All right, it gets personal with us. I mean, but again, it's a safe place to let all that stuff come out. You're saying that because you're dealing with it from an issue of privilege. No, you're saying that because you're old. No, you don't even know me. I mean, this is how we get started. I mean, that's nowhere near the product. And then when we finish, there's no, you know, 1600s sense of kind of native consensus building or what. No, there's none of that. There's people sitting like this still because they didn't get a word in. I mean, literally get the word in. But it's that process of just forcing us to talk about things that otherwise we don't necessarily talk about. All right, let's take this image over here, and let's start this time with you reading what you wrote. And you've been cheating a little bit. Have you been writing still? This is what happens. See, you have bright, task-oriented people. They want to complete the task. Oh, quick. You know what? I'm sorry. All right, that's fine. I'm sorry to bore you with another story, but this one's real quick. We had a professor who experimented on students, which is almost always a bad idea. But the experiment, it was a course in ethics, a literature course in ethics. And so what he did was to ask them to write a manual describing proper waterboarding techniques and how you could promote waterboarding, you know, like from a publicity standpoint, if you were a government interested in doing it. And the way you failed it was by doing the exercise. You know, I mean, if you just did it, you failed, right? But the students were so bright, they actually went, some of them, and wrote these incredible manuals on how you would do a publicity campaign to sell waterboarding to a people. And got angry because, again, bright, task-oriented people, that they didn't get an A. Because they had come up, you see the whole point? And we had some professors that were upset. Well, yeah, but look at the work. The writing is great, the penmanship. I mean, just ridiculous stuff. Missed the whole point of the whole exercise. I don't know where that came from. Anyway, give me your now 25 words exactly since you've had a chance to.
Okay. And it is actually 25 words.
I knew it would be.
Just for the record, it was 25 words exactly before we ended.
Okay, all right.
Yes. Commonly sold souvenir items, like this note box, depicted African Americans in demeaning, dehumanizing ways. What does this represent? How does this make you feel?
That's about as safe. I mean, it actually, it's not as safe as the Oscar Mayer group. That's your name. It's not as safe as, and when you do workshops, it's always good to insult the people in there, kind of like with audiences and stuff, because that's like rule number one to not do. So the first part, read the first sentence again.
Commonly sold souvenir items, like this note box, depicted African Americans in demeaning, dehumanizing ways.
Okay.
And we originally had it as black male, but then, so my last minute editorial change was just because, although there's a male featured
right.
in that, I thought that the statement should address that this is
sure.
about all black people. It's not
mm-hmm.
just males
mm-hmm.
that were depicted in the
mm-hmm. Okay. And what were the two questions you asked at the end?
What does this represent? How does this make you feel?
All right, now just to be a jerk about it, just... actually, you just told him what it represented, right? In the sentence you had before that. So now you. But the last question. What's the last question?
How does this make you feel?
See, now that one's, and you guys were kind of getting into that some. I mean, yeah, I. That's a B. All right, so that's. Well, first of all, you told me. All right, you said this. Did you say commonly produced object, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, is it old or new?
We think that that's really not the point.
Oh, that's not the point. So it's not the point if something is made today versus 60 years ago.
Well, they use past tense.
In this case, I mean, because we had this conversation, in this case, we think that that might be an oldish thing, maybe a few decades old, but the point that we didn't want to limit our description as being historically specific, because
okay.
while that specific item might not be for sale right now, there are things that are the equivalent of that that are everywhere.
No, I get that, and I like that point. But is it also the case that sometimes when people come in, one of the ways they create distance is by saying that it's old. And so if you say it's newer or contemporary, which I don't know, maybe it is or not. Do you think it's old?
Not necessarily.
I'm going to need a real answer. Do you think? when do you think this was made? Give me a decade.
I would guess the 70s.
This is probably late 50s and 60s. Okay, now so that's half a century ago. Is that? I don't know. If you've been in museums, almost everything up there gives you some sense of when it was, right? Because it might matter. It might not matter, but it might matter. See, maybe that. In other words, what I'm saying is you had those that one sentence, that's the question sentence, and so that gives you like another 3-4 words or whatever that was, and. I don't know. It may not be relevant that this is half a century ago. Okay. It may not be relevant that it's half a century ago, and yet the same object is reproduced today. But that's certainly a big point to some of what we're trying to do. See where I'm going with that? Mm-hmm. All right. Where you say it was made in St. Petersburg or Florida?
Well, there again, we started with a lot more information,
uh-huh.
and then we had to get it.
All right, so, but you felt like...
that was already there.
Yes, it was already there. Okay, good. And did you say, you said what it was? It's a note...
box.
Note box, that's good. So the person knows, because this is a case where you might not know what it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. As you view the one, this over here, what are some of your reflections on what they're saying? Or about this, or said about this?
I was thinking exactly what you said, which is, and this is exactly that problem. You do take a strong line in saying, judging it right off, and then you back off and say, what does it represent to you? But you can't do that if you've just told people, because then it's like it's a null question, right?
Yeah.
So you're not giving, I mean, what are they supposed to say? Like, they'd have to be really aggressively against what you said, too, because it's an authoritative voice. If you go in a museum, there's a label,
uh-huh.
right? So, but it's that problem that we struggle with, too.
Uh-huh. You know, one last thing on this other point. I actually had someone say to me, and this is a discussion we have all the time, that only members of the group that's depicted should be able to write the panels for those. And we spent months dealing with that kind of idea. My point is, or my stance rather is that I want intelligent, thoughtful people, including members of various groups, to participate in all the construction, the storytelling, and the like, and that if it is the case, not from experience in a way that we sometimes mean it, but if it is the case that a person has a greater insight about something, of course, you know, we lean in that direction in terms of text and the like. Maybe that's my weenie way of trying to deal with it. All right, what challenges did you face as a... did you face any challenges, or what was difficult about this thing?
Locating it in a much bigger picture of continuity, and I mean that's in one little souvenir item, but it's one thing in very big context.
Okay.
So choosing very few words which can convey both the longevity of stereotyping.
Okay.
Forms.
Can you read the first sentence again?
No.
Do that.
Can I read it? Absolutely.
Aggressive group too, isn't it? You know? Hell no. We read it twice. Pay attention. You know. Go ahead.
Commonly sold souvenir items like this notebook.
See right there, that was good because you got a whole bunch of souvenir or whatnot or whatever you want to call them. Okay. That's good. So one challenge was trying to figure out how to place, how people don't just see it as a thing in and of itself, right, but part of something. Okay. So you made it a part of commonly sold souvenir objects, but you could have gotten even bigger, broader than that, because, I mean, there was those common souvenir objects were part of, you know, all everyday objects, right, that were used, license plates and whatever else. But I like the way you were thinking. All right, what other challenges or what other things did you struggle with?
I'll be honest, I didn't express this, but, you know, when you come into a room and we're discussing, and I'm just as vulnerable as anybody is saying, who has the authority here? Like, I'm walking into a room with a lot of, you know, young Caucasian people here, and I'm sitting down looking at an item that I have a different viewpoint on. It's not a right or wrong viewpoint. It's a different viewpoint, but it's personal.
Yeah.
It's very personal.
Yeah.
And, it's very interesting how I feel, the emotions that it provokes to me sitting at the table. But like I said before, if she was the only person who was at a certain march and I wasn't there, right now I would have to accept that she's the authority of who is a witness to what went on.
Uh-huh.
As well as, you know, I might meet a Klans member. Mm-hmm. I want to talk to him anyway because he may have information that I need. And I think as Black folks, it's a challenge for us.
Uh-huh.
So it was a bit of a challenge, you know, for me to sit in this group and, you know, just hear everybody's, you know, hearing those words repetitively, dehumanizing, you know. It's hard.
Yeah. Well, and I think...
It's an honest feeling, God.
Sure. You know, no, that's good. It's good. I think that you put your hand on something, which is, it's not so much the authority piece, it's that we experience the pain of pieces differently. But that doesn't give me that. I mean, there is an insight about that pain, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean necessarily that I know anything more about the history of this, or the manufacturer, or even understand in some deeper way some other things. But certainly we experience that. So yeah, that was good. What did you learn about the members of your group? I don't mean this in a. Don't you guys have, like, docent shops where you sit and do this and beat each other up for a while? You don't do that much yet? You haven't got to that point? No, I don't mean it like that. Well, I'm saying, what did you learn about as you listened to people talking in the group? What did you learn? Start with you. So you think this exercise would have been different with a different configuration of people?
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
So, okay. Can you understand why this is like the second of eight exercises? It's not number eight. Yeah, it's still on the sort of icebreaker end of the whole thing. Okay, it's actually not second, it's like third or whatever. But it's early on, it's not one of the later ones. Right, what did you learn about the group or felt about or whatever? I'm tired and not coherent. You were in the group. I watched you interact with each other. So, anyone?
You get a bit of a sense of, I guess, what people's strengths are and interests, right? So, you talked a lot about the history and you were good with the writing. You brought with wording. It's a compliment. And you brought a perspective that I personally hadn't considered before. Like you brought things to the table I hadn't considered before. You know, so you get sort of this micro insight into how people work in a group.
Okay.
I also want to say that like I've spent most of my childhood and education in the United States, so I don't know like the background of anybody in this group.
Okay, anyone else?
My problem's formulating.
That's all right, that's okay.
I found that when we were talking about the box that we were trying to use a lot of, I don't know, objective terms. And I kind of brought it up at one point. It's like, I don't really see how we can talk about something like this in objective terms. I don't see how we can leave out, like you were saying last night, you know, the venom in certain words have to be kind of brought out and discussed in that way, because it's, you know, that's what it is. That's where it comes from. And I don't think it's really fair, I guess, to just say, oh, well, you know, it's this letterbox, and just, you know, just look at it from a historical perspective. And I think that's where, you know, the, you know, personal insights are coming handy. So personally, I don't think I'd be able to, you know, I don't have the same kind of connection, and I wouldn't be the person for it, but we definitely need someone that has an emotional reaction to it a lot stronger, should be a part of it.
And I think that sort of accounts for the aggressiveness of our panel description, right? Is that we wanted to...
It wasn't that aggressive.
Well,
but
the slightly... Well, whatever.
I guess it's all relative.
Okay. Because we took a stance on
yes.
what we thought it was, right?
Yes.
And so that was in part an attempt to address the fact that this is a vicious object. So listening to what this gentleman was just saying, I was thinking, though, I mean, I think it is really incredibly important, and that's something that didn't come up in either of the first two rounds, not only sort of, you know, subjective, objective about authority, but the emotional issue. And so is there a place in labels for emotion? You know, that's part of that experience, like, okay, we experience things differently. But I want to slightly take issue with the idea that people who have been victims of a particular kind of racism, they're the only ones who actually have emotions about this. Because what about emotions like shame, for example, right? And so, you know, people who are on the sort of privileged or beneficiary ends of these systems, I think maybe you have to dig a little bit deeper, but I think getting to their emotions about that is another thing that really could be important stuff to mine for conversation and for, like, learning.
Mm-hmm.
Could I just...
Yes, absolutely.
That quickly? Because we've sort of been circling back and returning to this issue that at certain points in the conversation has come under the frame of authority and who has authority. And, you know, as a sort of lifelong student, but also someone who is a teacher, I've seen so many times a situation where something comes up about race, and a lot of often very well-meaning white people turn their heads to the room and look at the person of color. You know, and I think that part of the problem with that is that it places a certain burden. I mean, we can think of this as a division of labor, right? Why should it only be, you know, people of color's responsibility to take up these issues or to speak about them or to, you know, put emotion on the table, sort of like what Erica was saying. I mean, we're all in the same world together, and I think that's part of the hegemony of whiteness, right, is that it becomes the invisible placeholder that's seen as neutral and seen as not needing the same sort of deconstruction or questioning. But it should be just as up for, you know, debate and dissection as...
Well, don't you see how, in a kind of ironic way, a white person refusing to engage just becomes another way to get there.
Right.
You know, and to not be engaged while their heart being in the right place, you know, as it were.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times, you know, you talked about the journey. I think a lot of times, because I did a lot of work as an undergrad with, social activism around race issues. And one of the things that we found at this small liberal arts school that I attended, Swarthmore in Philadelphia, and this came out of an English class I took called Whiteness and Racial Difference, in which we basically found that no one could talk about whiteness. It was only, people could talk about blackness, but we just couldn't sort of put the so-called center under view. And, you know, there had been an incident on campus, and there were multiple support groups of various communities, but there's no group for white people for understandable historical reasons, right? But what was happening as a result of the sort of landscape of activism on my very progressive campus was that when a racial incident did occur, all of the groups were specific people of color and other you know, subaltern communities of different kinds rallied and had these frameworks for social and political action. And then the majority white population was just sort of sitting around, like, not actually doing anything, which is really messed up, right? Because, like, everyone should be out there protesting. Everyone should be talking.
talking.
Mm-hmm.
And this was stated among these support groups as a real point of frustration. You know, like, why is it that only we're showing up to
mm-hmm.
this stuff? And
mm-hmm.
I think it's because, you know, it's for a lot of reasons, but among a large contingent of white students, I think it was a performance of respect and
mm-hmm.
and recognition of the difference of experience
mm-hmm.
and the uneven
mm-hmm.
nature of the pain around
mm-hmm.
these issues.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just an example of where, you know, without the dialogue, good intentions can actually be
mm-hmm.
missed opportunities at best and, you know, perpetuations of,
mm-hmm.
of racism at worst.
Mm-hmm. I had a vice president. Before I became a vice president, when I was a professor, I wanted to build a Sarah Bartman room. Actually, when I met you guys at the University of Michigan, that's one of the things I said in the presentation. And I selected her because I thought she was the perfect intersection of racism, sexism, and colonialism. And also, I buy into the sort of the proverb that you're not dead until you're forgotten, and I don't want her forgotten. I don't think there's any chance of her being forgotten at this point, but... So I wanted to build this Sarah Bartman room, but it wouldn't just be about African women, poor African women, you know, exploited by the Dutch, things, whatever. It would be about all women, but have her name. And I went to the vice president at the time, the academic vice president. I was a tenured full professor and had been doing the work with the museum. And she said to me, I will not support you doing this. A, because I don't know where it's going to stop. You know, like, first you start with blacks and then women. Pretty soon you're just going to be building museums left and right. And that's ridiculous. You can put that on the camera. But the other point she actually said to me was, it's because you're not a woman. And I said to her, no, I'm not a woman. Okay? I am not a woman. But I've been studying women and collecting objects on women for a long time. Black women. I mean, all this... The so-called mammy caricature is of black women. The tragic mulatto, the sapphire. I've been studying women. What you're really saying is you don't want me studying white women. I mean, that's what it seems like, right? No, that's got nothing to do with it. I said, yeah, but I've been collecting stuff on all women of color. She says, no, we're not supporting that. Well, in that case, then sociology just needs to close down its field.
And
anthropology and all the other fields. Then we shouldn't have those fields, period. Absolutely not. The only person should be able to talk about this stuff is someone who got followed around the store today because they, you know, thought they might steal something. Okay. I have one last little thing, and I don't think we have time for it. But what I would like to do, though, how much time do we have?
Do we get to hear the original captions?
The original what?
What have you used?
Oh, for the panels for these? We don't have panels for them yet. Yeah. No, I'm not using yours. No, we may. What we're doing is, I said the process is more important than the outcome. In this sense, it could help me get to an outcome. I tell you though, if you ever read the panels that I've written, and like if you go on our website, look at the traveling exhibits, I am so much more aggressive than they are. You know, I'm like, you're an idiot if you wear this shirt. You know, you shouldn't have been born. You know, I'm not that far, but it's you know. And I should be more like this. That's what I've learned. All right, but what I want to show you this is for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's a what?
Clock.
It's a clock. Okay, and a clock is a everyday object. Okay, and it's a clock that is functional. Just like when you see a racist or a sexist ashtray, there are people that are actually using it as an ashtray. Or a fishing lure, they're using it as a fishing lure. Or an incense burner or whatever. And there's some Freudian stuff with that I'd love to share with you at some point. I have some ideas about some of those options. But anyway, so it has a function, which means that it's, actually it has multiple functions. Because for some people, they don't open it, and they actually use it as a kind of display piece, but other people would use it as a clock. I'm going to tell you a couple things that I didn't get a chance to say last night. Folks would say to me, like, why would someone collect this? And at first, it was really easy when I was younger to just summarily dismiss people that collected quote, you know, just call them racist and move on to the next thing. And every year I discover more and more types of collectors. The biggest type will always be in my mind, people that believe there's money to be made. Because there was a period, especially in the 1980s and 1990s, where the prices of this stuff escalated to a point where it was fool's gold. You know, it was tulips, the whole tulip thing all over again. And stuff that I paid 25 cents for was selling for $500, that kind of stuff. And so there's this hope, this speculative hope. That, so that's a big category. And you've heard me talk about people like myself who are like educating collectors or heritage collectors, depending on what it is, using the objects to try to do the kind of things that we did today. But a couple of other groups I've discovered. Oh, by the way, and of course, there's the group that buys it because they believe that these images are accurate, or there's a kind of nostalgic thing going for the past, as it were. But I recently met a person who collected tiles, you know, floor tiles, and had some tiles, I mean, and literally tens of thousands of them. You know, 10,000 of anything looks impressive, you know, as a collection, but just an incredible collection of tiles. And a couple of the tiles were like really racist. And would not give them to me, whatever. He's what I would call now a type collector. He's got to have every tile. So he's got to have the racism. Now, at some level somewhere, there may be some stuff going on or whatever. But, you know, after long conversations, I'm convinced that there are more and more people that I wasn't aware of them for a long time. They just have to have every one of that thing, okay? Now there's this other group that I've been running more across, and those people are really thumbing their nose at political correctness as they see it, or norms or whatever. And basically it's kind of a maverick thing, you know, saying to the government, the neighborhood, their friends, whatever, you don't tell me what to do. This is, you know, it's an act of defiance, like Zorro doing the Z on the side of things, right? And I'm meeting more and more people who are collecting newer pieces because you can't really expect this to go up in value. It's a cheap reproduction. So you got to be collecting it for some other reason. And again, put it in on my mantle. My neighbors come over. I'm not ashamed of it. And when they ask me about it, I tell them, nobody tells me what to do. This is my home. I'm free. That kind of things. Okay? So I'm running across more and more of those. And then there are people that, although this wouldn't be an example of one, that are collecting what I call sick collectibles, or disgusting collectibles. So they collect, like, images of lynchings, but also executions and advanced stages of diseases and birth defects and the like. It just, you know, I can't think of a better term than sick collectibles. So I originally thought there was only four categories of collectors, but apparently there's a bunch. Now, what can I tell you, or what can you quickly tell me about this piece? I just told you it was new. As a matter of fact, it's almost brand new. But what can you tell about it?
Does it say something on the bottom?
Yeah, it says Sure Catch Smoky Fly Paper. There ain't no flies on us. And so it's an advertisement. All right. But something should jump out at you really quickly. The object is new, but the image is what?
Old.
And that is very common, to take old postcards and trade cards and anything flat, you know, labels that were on cans of soup or whatever, and then to reproduce them and place them on a new object, as it were. And I think one of the most powerful parts of the new museum will be where we have, say, 1,000 brand new objects, which are old but new at the same time. Okay. All right, well, what we have time real quick, if there's any person who had something they wanted to say and didn't get it in, or I cut them off in some rude way and they'd like a moment to say what they really wanted to say, and I'll shut up.
This is something, I read the paper Monica wrote about the museum forever ago, and it's always been in my head. How do you deal with paying money for these objects?
Well, my flippant answer used to be, they won't give it to me.
Yeah.
And so, and by the way, the pieces that I have in the museum are not a sample. They are not a sample of what I saw. I mean, they're a sample of what I could afford. The really horrific pieces, you know, puzzles called Chopped Up Niggas and all kind of vicious and vile stuff, I couldn't afford them. Or, because I was like, well, I would say I was like you, I don't know your financial situation. I was like me, and I didn't have money. And so I would have to not only pay for stuff, I'd have to put a lot of thought into what I could afford, which is kind of like going out and getting a switch that you're going to be beaten with, you know. So what I decided is that there is a market, that market is going to exist whether I participate in it or not, and I know what I'm doing with it. And so I would just hold my nose and go in and, you know, I had a nice discussion last night with someone. More problematic for me was not the paying for objects as it was the negotiation, negotiating the price, because a lot of it was like flea markets and the lot. And I would have loved to have had enough money that if someone had $20 on something, I could just go, here's the $20, you know, and whatever. But because, again, I needed as much, my money needed to go as far as it could go, I had to negotiate. Now, that's a really interesting dynamic. But I think that the more that I believe in the rightness of what I was doing and the outcome one day, I was able to kind of, you know, deal with that. Although, as I explained last night, I lost my balance, you know, a few times along the way. I think a huge mistake, and someone on this table was dealing with that a little bit, it may have been you, a mistake I made to create space and distance. Like the other, everybody creates distance when they come in there. I'll tell you one that I did. For a long time, I tried to hide my emotional stuff behind just being academic. And I would focus on theories of prejudice and theories of stereotyping and theories of, in other words, the stuff they had told me at Ohio State, which is like not complete, okay? And that was my way of trying to not experience each object each time I had to deal with it. All right? Now, the way I was able to rationalize that was by saying, I try to experience the object when I first get it at some level. And in that way, and then I put it in some kind of academic context, or framework, rather, so that when I'm then having to discuss it, I don't have to relive all of that because I got a nice little safe place for myself. And what happened was one person came into the museum one day, and it actually was a, sounds like a short story, it was an African-American woman and a European-American male. And I don't notice for a fact, but I think they were together, you know, partners. And the reason I say it is because, observing them together, and everyone else had left. And it wasn't even my class. I was, one of my friends had asked me to take his class in there because I try to train teachers to do that for themselves. And she, the session was over, and we had a really engaging kind of thing, right? And it was over, and they wouldn't leave. And so I was like, you know. And she was like really upset. And she was looking at that print I showed last night, that 1896 print of the children naked. She was just staring at that. And you could look at that and realize that, you know, it was causing her a lot of stuff. You know, she's trying to come to grips with the mind that produced that. And so, you know, she's standing in front of it, and they're talking a little bit together and talking whatever, and I'm standing over to the side. Because, again, in there I don't talk a whole lot, and I'm just letting people, you know. And so she left, and then he came over to me, and he said this, and I'm tired and been traveling a lot, so when I get like that, I get a little emotional, all right? But he came over, and he said, Dr. Pilgrim, I'm sorry. And I was like, dude, don't, you know, I'm good with this. You know, I mean, I'm spending my whole life trying to, don't worry, you know, stop, you know. And he was like, no, I'm sorry. And it was like in Goodwill Hunting where the guy won't stop, you know what I mean. And I was like, okay, you know, I get that. That's fine. I mean, I get that. But you didn't make this. we could argue and debate about to what extent you are privileged to live in a society that did make it and all of that. And I go to all the white privilege conferences, and I know all that. I says, you know, that's all good. You know, don't worry about it. I appreciate you saying that. So he says, no, I'm sorry. I'm like, this dude ain't going to leave. You know what I mean? So I said, okay, fine. You know, and I hugged him and everything. And I live 45 minutes from that door to my door in my city. And I got in my car and just started crying. I mean, like Old Testament weeping and gnashing. I mean, just some sackcloth. Don't look at her when I say Old Testament. I mean, you know, I got a Bible too. But she knows what I'm talking about when I talk about Jeremiah. I'm talking about wailing and carrying on. And I couldn't get myself together for a minute, right? And for me, when I have emotional stuff, I gotta then figure out what happened, right? So I gotta figure out, well, okay, I was tired, I was, you know, this is my, you know, decade time for experiencing this emotional stuff about this material, whatever. So I'm going through all this silliness. And then I realized, no, it's none of that. What it was for the first time in my life, I actually had a white person say, I'm sorry. And not in some liberal bullshit way, not in some white privilege conference way, not in some healing racism way, not that I'm putting all of that stuff down, but I've been to all of that. I'm talking about just one soul to another soul. And he had just said, I'm sorry. And that wasn't the part that made me cry. The part was, I realized in the car I needed to hear it. And I never thought I needed to hear it. You know, and I never believed people when they said they needed to hear it. But I started crying. And I don't know what happened to that guy. And I tried to find, try to find out what his name was. I guess I could have, because I could have got it from Philip. But, you know, I never made contact with him again. But, you know, I guess I needed to hear that. But needing to hear that doesn't mean I know more about that object than he would know. You understand what I mean? But it does mean that there was something different in a way. But that differenceness is a difference of sameness, because we were two people in a conversation, not one. You understand? And so it's to say only I could know something, it's not true. It was a symbiotic thing. I don't know why I shared that. I am obviously tired. So anyway, I'm not a robot. And I get that criticism. People say to me sometimes, oh, you're too sterile and clinical about it. But I did find out that if you try to do that too much, like some of my black friends, they're always saying, well, we get tired of bleeding in these sessions. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm like, yeah, you know, I understand that. You know. But dialogue is difficult. Well, okay. You didn't get that on tape, did you? I want that tape. No, I'm serious. I want that tape.
Okay.
I don't mean a copy of the tape. I mean, I want that tape. Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to say it's the first time in about 18 years that I have not been into a school for Black History Month.
Okay.
And, I was telling Louisa this morning over coffee that I need to replenish myself. I need to hear brothers and sisters who think like me, who have a mission, and it's okay to not be doing what I love to do this year, because I really need to go out and be fed, and I got a little food today, so that's really good for me.
Well,
it's good.
Well, and you fed me, and the rest of us.
Absolutely, because
right?
I go into schools every year. I'm the Kwanzaa lady in Montreal. I've been doing Kwanzaa in the elementary schools for the longest time, and I still have other places I want to go. I want to be in the high schools, and just coming here and seeing this workshop and how you do it, I have ideas now to go into tomorrow. And this month is Black History Month, and for some reason I feel at this point in time in our city is that the movement is stagnating. That through this great technology that we have, like the social network, that somehow something happened the struggle that we're in is not over, but it seems like everybody's sleeping. We used to have the East-West Conference in Montreal, the Pan-African Conference. We used to have so many things going on here, and it seems like when I walk into a room like this, one of the things that I'm aware of is that I don't see people that need the knowledge that I feel is important, you know? And so I hope everybody that goes out there and meets someone will tell somebody about the wealth that we have within our community, and not to forget our history.
Absolutely. And absolutely.
It's everybody's history. Black history is everybody's
history.
I am Black history. Mm-hmm. And everybody here is Black history.
So you should have filmed that for a PSA. You could... We could get some. That's better than the one that's on the state stands. Mm-hmm. By the way, you don't have to use negative or demeaning objects to do the things we do. And you asked me a question about spending money. The museum, when we're moved, will have quote positive sections. And when that occurred to me that I could do that. And was going to do that, it became a whole lot easier to spend my money. So to buy a 1963 sign that says, I am a man, although they're overpriced, by the way, that felt a whole lot better to reach into my back pocket to get that. To purchase the ink pen, or one of the ink pens that LBJ used to sign the 60, that felt really, I bought that for $20 on eBay. It's got the presidential seal, it's got the whole thing, it was just perfect, and someone stole it. And that's all right with me. You know, you heard me last night that God forgives that kind of thing. So buying some of the art, buying the pieces that are really redemptive, you know, the storybooks and all that's just a whole lot easier. But it's also just part of the story, you know, or stories that we're going to take.
Do you have a budget for this, or is it still...
Oh, I have, well, you know, that's interesting you ask that, because I have people watching me all the time about how I spend my budget, because they see the Jim Crow Museum as my project. And another mistake I made was when I took this job, I distanced myself from the museum, because I didn't want people thinking I was using my position to do that. And then it's just, that was a mistake. And so now, not only have I become a champion again for it, raising money and doing other stuff, you know, this is the epiphany I had. If I had nothing to do with it, and I woke up one day and I was vice president of diversity and inclusion, isn't that the kind of project I'd be supporting with my budget? Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's what I said to myself. So my opponents, whatever, they can say whatever they want to, but now if I see something I want that the museum needs, I'll purchase it, and I have quite a bit of money to do that. And what's ironic is that now that I'm finally in a position where I have thousands of dollars to purchase stuff, people started giving us stuff. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned last night, a guy gave us a collection. It was probably a $1,000 collection, at least, maybe double that. I did that because I don't know if his heirs are watching.
Oh, okay.
But so people are giving us stuff, and also I'm much more prudent with other people's money than I, you know. And I was cheap with my money because I didn't have much. But there's a black. If you ever get a chance, this would be good for you that are interested in this field. Every year in D.C. there is a Black Memorabilia Conference or convention. And actually people giving papers and stuff there. But it's mostly about making money and everything. But I went a few years ago, and there was like 600 tables. I mean, usually when you go to a flea market, there's like five tables that have something you want, right? But this one would have like 800 tables, and it's only that stuff. And it's really interesting, the racial dynamic, too, though, because... when it first started, it was almost all black dealers and white customers. And now that's like kind of reversed a little bit because, again, these things are worth money. If it's a picture of a lynching, it has a secondary market value, you know. But the other part about going to that conference is that I had a chance to buy so-called Negro League memorabilia, and to buy, like, I bought a beautiful charcoal painting of Madam C.J. Walker, and other and people that are much that are less well known than she is, and so you can go in and you can buy like some civil rights stuff, you know. Like there was a guy there that had Panther stuff, you know, and someone, and I don't idolize any of those groups. With me, I try to be objective. That's the sociologist in me. I love a lot of, like, the Buffalo Soldiers, what they stood for. I don't like the fact that any of them raped Native women. Mm-hmm. And if I give a presentation, I'm going to say both of those things. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of stuff. So, but I found some nice Buffalo Soldier memorabilia while I was there. So, you know, I'm still out collecting, but I'm not as, you know, collecting as much. We have a lot of people giving us stuff now. And if you have some stuff, matter of fact, Erica was nice enough to give us it. She made me sign some tax stuff to get it, but well, anyway, Concordia has been wonderful. It has absolutely been wonderful. I needed this. I don't know why, but you know.
I'm thinking I'm gonna shut you down.
Yeah, I'm done.
Okay. Just because we need to feed you and you need to do an interview, but whatever. But if I'm sure if anybody had like questions for Dr. Pilgrim that they want to ask him one on one, you know, we can give you a few minutes for that. And, but otherwise, thank you. This was really great.
Well, thank you. Did you guys get your micro argument?